The army doesn't like more than one disaster in a day.
Looks bad in the newspapers and upset civilians at their breakfast.
I'm Bill Buford. Welcome to War Notes, a conflict podcast in which we will be taking a journey into history, discussing contemporary events, and even doing some conflict futurism, this clash and collision between complex adaptive systems armed to the teeth to see who will prevail and see what it tells us about the human condition and why we can't stop. Hello, this is Bill, and welcome to War Notes, a conflict podcast. This is episode 19. The title of this episode is Power Failure, a Thought Experiment on U.S. Expeditionary Vulnerability. A little bit of housekeeping. Just returned from a two-week hiatus on vacation, Oconus. Wife and I had a great time, and then we got to spend a little bit of time for my youngest daughter's birthday in southern Arizona. She stayed there an additional week. I had to come back because I have a day job and I had to make a living. The saintly wife stayed down there an additional week in southern Arizona, which just so happens to be the environs in which we had lived for 17 years before we made our move back home to Florida, me being an OG Floridian, born here, as a matter of fact, in Miami, Florida. That's not where we live. We live on the Gulf Coast. And I'm really happy to have returned here. I'm really happy that I left an Arizona that is increasingly Californicated. Met some great folks on my vacation who I'll be corresponding with. And there's going to be some surprises in store for my audience over the next few months. And I'm looking forward to unveiling those. So let's get on with this. It's been a while since I've been behind the mic because of vacation and everything like that. And I wanted to hit the nub of what I'm after here. I wouldn't say this is the first time that I'm conducting an episode-long thought experiment. Those are the kind of things that we would likely do in a STEM environment, a science, technology, engineering, and math environment, where we would come up with hypotheses and we would throw things on the wall and we would see if the syllogisms and the statements that we made above the line answer the sum of what we suppose that hypothesis is in the end. So that's what I propose to do here today. For those of you who are new listeners, welcome aboard. For those of you who have been listening for a while, I am ever grateful for your patronage and listenership. If you get the opportunity, I would love for you to leave starred reviews on the podcast vendor of your choice that you may be listening to the sound of my voice as we speak, and better yet, write narrative reviews. And also, I have a Substack that you can go to if you wish to put comments in the episodes that are posted there. That was one of the primary reasons why I got the Substack in the first place, because I am one of those guys who has been in the netverse for the longest time, who takes great pleasure not simply reading comments directed at myself from my audience per my podcast, but I tend not only to be skeptical of outlets that don't have a commentariat or that function whatsoever, but I really enjoy reading the conversation and the Socratic drilling and cross-examination that goes on in conversations that are in the comments. So I am obliged if you just so happen to leave those. So I invite you to my Substack, and if you wish to get in touch with me, that is going to be cgpodcast@pm.me. That is cgpodcast@pm.me. You know, what I wanted to do here was talk about the vulnerabilities of the U.S. war machine. For those of you who are new to the podcast, and this may be your first one, I wouldn't exactly say that the linear or non-linear of my episodic journey throughout all these, after all, this is episode 19 of War Notes, but I just published episode 69 in Chasing Ghosts, which was the CG mailbag, Question Time, and the Backbencher's Lament, where for the longest time, over a year, I had neglected to have an annual homage to all the great correspondence that I get from my listeners. Thanks again for doing that. So what I've talked about again and again is that with the U.S. war machine, it is not only the most expensive, but probably the most lethal land force, air force, and naval force on Earth that is a 20th century permutation of that particular excellence that is not fit for purpose for 21st century peer conflict anywhere. Now, I come to this conclusion with hat in hand because this is not the conclusion that I want to come to. I want to think that every dollar spent, every life lost, every life injured for the rest of their lives, every moral injury imposed upon the American soldiers, sailors, Marines, and airmen, and everything in between has been for good measure and for good use and has been efficacious in being neutral or beneficial to the American security state, but it appears that that is not the case. The Scott Horton Academy has retained me not only as their Smedley D. Butler Fellow for Military Affairs at the Libertarian Institute, but at Scott's new venture, his College Academy, at which I am a fellow in conflict studies. One of the courses that I'm doing there that I've almost got complete is American Stalemate and Defeat from 1945 to the present day. And that just so happens to be the sterling track record that this big and ultimately ineffective fighting machine has not only achieved to this point, but will continue to achieve in the future through the reliance on exquisite platforms and acquisition system that would make the Soviets blush, and a failure in technology development that is breathtaking in so many ways that I have bored my listeners with in both Chasing Ghost and this War Notes podcast. I would suggest that America is uniquely vulnerable to losing the next fight in an even more dramatic fashion than it has lost fights in the past. In a way that through the use of hybrid warfare, gray zone warfare, asymmetric warfare, and even conventional conflict, which the United States prides itself on being so spectacular and good at doing that very thing, even though there's no proof that that can even be approached after the temporary victory that became a stalemate and became a defeat in Iraq in 1991, ultimately leading to the United States for reasons that did not bear up under evidence or scrutiny in 2003 for that particularly bad application of operational art and strategic failure, which is the American involvement in Iraq between 2003 and its denouement in the 20-teens. I would like to caution you on some term usage. I am going to suggest to you, especially those who are professional conflict observers, or you've been a conflict and war observer all of your adult life, is that the terms near peer and peer will no longer appear in my podcast. I think the revolutions of military affairs in hypersonics, robotics, autonomous targeting, and literally dozens of other smaller permutations on in what war looks like for the remainder of the 21st century are such that the flattening of that war-making hierarchy, the ability of nation states that aren't only near peer, but are third world, fourth world developing nations, and their ability to inflict tremendous damage on the very expensive, exquisite platforms that America fields in its military in a very limited fashion, unfortunately, because America is running out of exquisite platforms that work. This is everything from the manned tank to the aircraft carrier and everything in between. Those of you who have listened to me for a while know that I consider the aircraft carrier not only be a tremendous waste of money and a moral injury on the hinge of reality that will snuff out 5,000 souls if it finds itself too close in the Pacific, for instance, to the very formidable A2, AD, and IAMD, integrated air missile defense systems, that the Chinese have in place from their mainland to the second and third island chains, those island chain radii that keep going out year after year further and further, until pretty soon our aircraft carriers won't have to deploy to be out of missile range of these Chinese missiles, because if they find themselves in the ports in San Diego or elsewhere on the West Coast, they will be within missile range of the Chinese. Fortunately, if they happen to be sunk in port, and I'm knocking on wood here, hoping that never transpires, the less deep water in San Diego may make the salvage efforts a little easier. Now, whether the countries are ones that America seems to have been at war with for decades, like Iran, like Yemen, like countless Middle Eastern countries, of late the Chinese, who have had this tremendous military transformation in the last 30 years that almost matches up to the martial industrialization that we saw from Japan from 1870 to 1933, and then, of course, what that led to in the interregnum between World Wars I and II. So I'd like to talk about self-deception. I'd like to talk about hybrid warfare. I'd like to talk about asymmetric warfare. I'd like to talk about the glad-handing that flag officers have been doing since the end of the Vietnam War, arguably since the end of World War II. If pressed, and I am asked, is there a flag officer worth his salt of all of them, whether admiral or general, that we have in the armed services today, since their only talent set seems to be Machiavellian intrigue, palace whispers, backstabbing, and being culling connoisseurs, I do not classify most of the flag officers who are currently serving as anything more than political apparatchiks who couldn't fight their way operationally or strategically out of a paper sack, much less have the tactical efficacy to fight in a peer conflict in the 21st century. We simply lack a core that even has a hint of the martial imagination and intellectual flexibility, and I would add even moral certitude, to do the right thing as far as these wars of choice that America has been participating in since 1871 with the abortive, I guess you could call it, micro-colonial efforts in Korea and everything in between. So before we get started today, I wanted to frame this within the Millennium Challenge Exercise 2002 that occurred from the defunct U.S. Joint Forces Command when General Van Riper, USMC, was selected as the Red Team. The Red Team would be that team who would be fighting against Blue, fighting against the good guys. He would be representative and emblematic of the enemy that they wanted portrayed in there so that the American military could flex its muscles in this very expensive exercise, most of which is via computer. He was a 3-star at the time. And find out whether all of its thinking was appropriate with everything that it had at hand to win. Well, it turns out that there's an article by a fellow by the name of Micah Zenko, who wrote a book I really enjoyed called Red Team, How to Succeed by Thinking Like the Enemy. What I love about red teaming and contrarians and 10th men is I think that all large bureaucratic organizations, whether they are military or civilian, should have a cell, a single man, or a coterie of folks who are there to say not only does the emperor have no clothes, but can substantively tell you why that's the case. For those who've been in the military, you'll understand. For those who were not, you'll grow to understand with this suggestion. When the military does these very expensive exercises, which are basically toots, tactical exercises without troops, where you get all the bigwigs, the field grades, and the flag officers, you get them in several rooms, maybe over a continent or two, they are connected by computer and they're guiding parts and pieces on a mainframe that they see, well, they're like playing a big game of cybernetic risk with all of the exquisite platforms, bringing all of the information, values, and strategies and tactics and operational thinking to actually participating in a war game that allows them to take a measure of the capability of their forces that they have at hand and their ability as leaders to do so. In this case, quoting from the article that I will have in the show notes for you, Millennium Challenge 02 was intended to be the largest, most expensive, most elaborate concept development exercise in the U.S. military history. The exercise was mandated by Congress to explore critical warfighting challenges at the operational level of war that will confront United States Joint Military Forces after 2010. Remember, this is conducted 8 years prior to 2010. Developed over 2 years at a cost of $250 million, it would grow to include 13,500 service members participating from 17 simulation locations and 9 live force training sites. It was promoted by Pentagon officials as a demonstration of leap-ahead technologies. It was intended to provide commanders with dominant battle space knowledge to conduct rapid, decisive operations against future adversaries. End of quote. So much word salad, so many buzzwords, so much garbage to really say we are going to bring these middling folks of limited martial imagination together so that we can fake it till you make it with present force design and force structure against an enemy that we have cooked to make sure that that enemy doesn't defeat us. Well, they did not have a full measure of General Van Riper, did they? Now, Van Riper had participated in previous war games for JIFCOM, including the previous year's Unified Vision 2001 exercise, in which he played the role of a landlocked regional power at one crucial engagement during Unified Vision 2001. Van Riper was informed by the White Cell or Control overseeing the game that the United States had destroyed all 21 of the Red Team's deeply buried ballistic missiles, even though the Blue Team commander never actually knew where they were located. It was simply assumed that in the future the U.S. would have the real-time radar and sensor capabilities to eliminate them. After the Unified Vision 2001 exercise, JIFCOM provided a report to Congress that claimed that the exercise had corroborated the effects-based operations concepts. When Van Riper complained this was untrue, he was promised regarding MCO2 that next year will be a free play and honest exercise. End of quote. You will take note that it says next year will be a free play and honest exercise, which is an admission by the Pentagon in their report to Congress that they had been fibbing. They had been lying to them because, of course, it wasn't one. Quote, we have a very, very determined op four, both live and simulation. This is free play. The op four has the ability to win here. Now, this doesn't mean that Millennium Challenge 02 was designed without constraints. It's common for military simulations to test concepts that will inform future personnel training and procurement decisions. For example, there was only a 36-hour window during which the live fire forced entry component of the experiment was to occur. End of quote, because I want to tell you something here that is so valuable for the remainder of this particular episode, and that is in these wars of choice that America has conducted since 1945, the expeditionary nature of American force projection forced by the two oceans that are on either side of North America force the function of America having to comport itself in an expeditionary fashion where its entire logistical chain and lines of communication and delivery of combat power has to take place via strategic transport, via airlift, sea lift, train lift to get to the coast, and all the rest of that. I want you to keep that in mind when we start talking about the focal point of this particular exercise. And then Van Riper does something that is unconscionable in the minds of those who like these chess games fixed, much like the mob would fix horse races in the past. Quote, since the George W. Bush administration recently announced the preemption doctrine, Van Riper decided that as soon as a U.S. Navy carrier battle group steamed into the Gulf, he would preempt the preemptors and strike first. Once U.S. forces were within range, Van Riper's forces unleashed a barrage of missiles from ground-based launchers, commercial ships, and planes, flying low and without radio communications to reduce their radar signature. Simultaneously, swarms of speedboats loaded with explosives launched kamikaze attacks. The carrier battle group's Aegis radar system, which tracks and attempts to intercept incoming missiles, was quickly overwhelmed and 19 U.S. ships were sunk, including the carrier, several cruisers, and five amphibious ships. The whole thing was over in 5, maybe 10 minutes, Van Riper said. End of quote. You will note here, this is 2002. He used these ships, these small boats, to intercept them. Now we have UAVs, FPVs, and drones in swarms that are huge compared to the minuscule swarms that I'm certain Van Riper deployed in 2002. He goes on, quote, the red team had struck a devastating blow against the blue team. The impact of the Op 4's ability to render a U.S. carrier battle group the centerpiece of the U.S. Navy, militarily worthless, stunned most of the MCO2 participants. Van Riper described the mood as an eerie silence, like people didn't really know what to do next. Blue team leader Bell admitted that the Op 4 had sunk my damn Navy and had inflicted an extremely high rate of attrition and a disaster from which we all learned a great lesson. Meanwhile, Kernan received an urgent call from Luck, General Luck. Sir, Van Riper just slimed all of the ships. Kernan recognized that this was bad news because it placed at risk JIFCOM's ability to fulfill the remaining live fire forced entry component of the exercise, a central component of MCO2. The actual forces were awaiting orders of Fort Bragg off the coast of San Diego in the Fort Irwin National Training Center. Kernan recalled, I didn't have a lot of choice. I had to do the forcible entry piece. He directed the White Cell to simply refloat the virtual ships to the surface. Bell and his blue team, now including the live fire forces operating under his direction, applied the lessons from the initial attack and fended off subsequent engagements from the red team. Now, during the entirety of this exercise, blue force eventually crushes the red force because they stymied, stopped, and silenced Van Riper from being able to do what he was trying to realistically do. Quote, Van Riper was not willing to let the matter drop. He wrote up a report detailing the numerous shortcomings of the war game, how it was controlled, and how the exercise could lead the Pentagon to have misplaced confidence in still untested military warfighting concepts. He handed 6 hard copies of the report to senior JIFCOM leaders, but never received any feedback. However, unlike the other concept development exercises, Van Riper believed that the MC-02 was both scripted and carried out in a way that did not realistically reflect likely future U.S. military capabilities or the threats posed by a thinking, motivated adversary. Wargaming is not normally corrupted, but this whole thing was prostituted. It was a sham instead to prove what they wanted to prove. Now, Van Riper would go on to continue his complaints. He would be ignored. And I am here to tell you that Van Riper, in the interceding 23 years, has been vindicated for having done what he did, because eerily and prophetically at the time, he was able to, having some platform problems and distinctions that he simply didn't have the technological vision for at the time, he was correct in seeing that the use and implementation of exquisite platforms as a primary means of force projection would play holy hell with American military efficacy in forcing an entry, much less establishing said beachhead or airhead, turning it into a lodgment, and using that as a means to oil spot into the remainder of the country that have been targeted. He has been proven right again and again, and I consider him to be quite sagacious at the time, and I really admire his moral courage at the time for calling the ball on how wrong they were in the way they did the model in Sims. It's funny, because later on, the vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at the time, General Peter Pace, declared flatly, quote, I absolutely believe that it was not rigged. Yet, JIFCOM itself later concluded the opposite. The final GIFCOM report on MCO2 ran 752 pages long, and being your happy interlocutor here, I spared you the burden of reading that, and I read it myself. I don't urge you to read it, but if you get the opportunity, you will be gobsmacked at how delusional, self-defeating, and just plain stupid the document is, and it did not age well. Finally, the GIFCOM report explicitly acknowledged, quote, as the exercise progressed, the Op4 free play was eventually constrained to the point where the end state was scripted. The scripting ensured a blue team operational victory and established conditions in the exercise for transition operations. End of quote. Why spend $250 million to do an exercise if in the end you aren't exercising so much as using this as a rubber stamp of the ambition and predetermined outcome that you had in the first place? The DoD should have tried to save some money, but that certainly is not within their charter. The article concludes, quote, MCO2 had become a shorthand reference for denigrating the cutting edge and unrealistic notions of military transformation that characterized the Rumsfeld era, a concept development exercise that was intended to socialize the military around the inevitability of a leap ahead futuristic transformation, ultimately left precisely the opposite impression, that it required a $250 million red team simulation and a motivated and justifiably angered former general officer to make this apparent, suggest that it was a highly useful experiment after all. That's Zenko's conclusion. That is not my conclusion, because my conclusion is that ever since that has happened in 2002, nothing has changed as far as America conducting these experiments and models and simulations and ensuring that they cook the books to make the blue team look good despite the fact that it isn't. Now, let's fast forward to this year, 2025, and see where we're at a mere 23 years afterwards. It appears, despite the fact, and I'm not blaming General Van Riper for this, because he probably simply didn't have the technological wherewithal to see what would happen now. For instance, I remember mentioning in a recent Chasing Ghosts podcast that you couldn't have told me in 2020 that by 2025, 80% of all battlefield casualties in the Ukraine, whether Ukrainian or Russian troops, would be because of drones, would because of FPVs and such. Now, what I just mentioned concerning America's wars of choice necessarily meaning that it means vast deployments, sea lifts, airlifts, train embarkations, debarkations, all kinds of things to get to the point at which the forward line of troops is to fight in these conflicts, whether, for instance, it is in Afghanistan or Iraq, Yemen, Libya, Syria, the Horn of Africa, and the host of other neo-imperialist mud pits that America has found itself involved in, again, wars of choice in the 21st century, they demand this very serious, deep, in wide sea lift and airlift to get there. And the vulnerabilities of those sea lift and airlift components, whether those are naval craft or merchant marine craft, commercial craft, same thing applies to aircraft, could be commercial airlines bringing in troops, could be military aircraft bringing in troops, whatever the fact may be, the vulnerabilities to those support mechanisms left of bang are extraordinary, and I don't know if the present United States military, I'm certain that there are some worthies and heavy thinkers in the Pentagon, as few and far between as they appear to be, who are considering and weighing these possibilities, but left of bang, left of D-Day, left of hostilities, all of these things logistically have to be conducted and orchestrated in a fashion in which they make it from point A to point B. Now, in military speak, these are declared ports of embarkation, which is where you step onto the sea lift or airlift. That would be your ESPO or your APO, P-O-E. And then what you would have at the point of your destination, whether it's your final destination or an intermediate destination, for instance, if this were to happen in the Ukraine or in a NATO country, one could arrive on the shores of England or arrive on the shores of France or Holland or wherever, and then find yourself at an intermediate destination that is not the ultimate destination, which would be the final, the forward line of troops, as it were. All of these permutations of moving men and materiel from one point on the globe to another are all soft points for exploitation by an enemy. For instance, if one finds oneself in that peer conflict I talked about, and you find yourself against a nuclear submarine capable foe, which would be Russia or China in this instance, during those Atlantic or Pacific crossings, the vulnerability of sea lift or airlift is going to be considerable. So this speaks to gray zone warfare, hybrid warfare, where it may not quite be conventional warfare, even though conventional means can be used to interdict these modalities. Hence, if you have even a commercial or merchant marine ship, most likely, like we saw in World War II, there would be escorts by military ships, by surface vessels assigned to the U.S. Navy or an allied navy, who would escort these across troubled waters, as it were, whether Atlantic or Pacific. Now, not only are these modalities vulnerable in transit, they are vulnerable once they reach their point, port, or APOD or S-POD of debarkation, where you debark, where all the men and materiel is removed from a ship or comes down the ramp of an aircraft to be rallied and lagered and fueled up for its next destination, maybe transposed on new shipping modalities, could be trains, could be trucks, could be other aircraft, whatever the case may be. All of these are vulnerabilities in the system of supply and provisioning of those forces that are forward. Now, any number of hazards, military or civilian, could be visited upon these. Those hazards could be self-imposed, like scheduling snafus and scheduling conflicts, and maybe orders of marches are confused. Maybe there is a mechanical difficulty that plagues a certain number of vehicles. Maybe through cybersecurity leaks or vulnerabilities, GPS is spoofed or it is apparently wrong in the estimates it gives of where one may be, how long it will take you to get where you need to be, and getting to the place that you need to be, maybe in the hazard. If somehow there are computer glitches that appear, these could be self-imposed, or the enemy can impose them on you through either active hacking or vulnerabilities that have been left as sleeper mechanisms inside the computer systems themselves, or any number of things that can occur as a result of being so reliant on computer systems for scheduling, maintenance, and moving things forward, and maintaining accountability of where those things are and where those things are going. What's going to happen if, for instance, as I've described in my Storming America series, there are sleeper cells that are in, let's suppose, Europe or Asian countries, whether we are fighting in the Pacific or the Atlantic, who have inserted themselves in a fashion where these cells can rise up and cause all kinds of grief, whether it is the sabotage of rail systems, mass transit systems, truck systems, stoppages on highways, whatever the case may be. All of these things can occur left of bang to deny the forward line of troops the provisioning and remanning that they would need necessarily in the kind of expeditionary warfare that the United States has to participate in these wars of choice. Not to mention that if this is a war that, even though I was discussing left of bang, has gotten hot already behind those who are fighting each other, Nothing stops, especially in this year, 2025, with the relative inexpensive price of missile technology, of missiles being lobbed against unprotected targets in the rear at these ports or points of debarkation of men and materiel and all the civilian support infrastructure that has to be in place to accommodate all of this, to get all of these expeditionary items of war to the place where they will be most effective in the fight. So again, all bets are off as far as the exposure of military forces left of bang before they even have a chance to get their finger in the trigger guard or have their weapons in a way that they can use them to fight an actual military enemy. I would suggest to everybody that from this point forward, for the remainder of this century, even in peer warfare, that is going to occur in a fashion that we haven't recognized up until this point. It does rhyme with history, because there are points at which this has occurred. One can look at Churchill's various ministries of ungentlemanly warfare, to include FDR's use of the Office of Strategic Services, the OSS, and Churchill's Special Operations Executive, and all the MIX variants that were part of that. And you see that when Churchill said, set Europe ablaze, he was doing that with unconventional and irregular forces. And I would suggest to you that that is precisely what's going to happen here. But it's not simply going to be those with the Fairbairn Sykes commando knives who are trained in the exquisite art of black operations and guerrilla warfare and what one could arguably say are terrorist operations at the time during World War II. All of this has been updated. All of this is occurring now as we speak, and we can think of many opportunities and examples of this having demonstrated itself, whether it's in Nagorno-Karabakh in Azerbaijan and Armenia when they fought each other in the fall of 2020, what's been happening in the Ukraine, what has happened in Syria, in all of these places in which conventional forces, while they weren't necessarily involved in some of these, they were direct recipients of a lot of the mischief and mayhem that would occur. Which brings me to the locus of this episode. And that would be the humble generator set. Let me suggest to all of my listeners out there that the 91 Delta generator set maintainer and technician, formally changed, I think, in 2009 from a 52 Delta military occupational specialty designator. That guy who has the lousy job, for those of you who spent time in the field of maintaining those generator sets, that could be anywhere from 10 kW to 150 kW and everything in between. The wrenchers, the guys who would come when all of a sudden the lights went out in the talk, or somebody had run over or tripped over a line, or for some reason the preventative maintenance hadn't been done on the genset, there wasn't one on standby, whatever the case may be, I want to suggest to you that in this year, 2025, those guys are just as critical and important as a general officer as I would suggest they were 25 years ago or 50 years ago. Because when you have an expeditionary military force, as is the United States in the projection of all of its forces, for the most part, it needs very clean 60 hertz power. Not 50 hertz power like the Russians use, but 60 hertz power. Now, not all grids are capable of delivering that. As a matter of fact, I would suggest to my humble listeners that it is more important than ever having clean power because of the military's increasingly hazardous reliance on computers for everything. Now, if the genset goes down, do the computers go down? Since the Army has, for the most part, adopted laptops, that isn't necessarily the case, but then they're running on batteries that have a limited shelf life unless recharged again. Now, I've mentioned to you two things in the past. emissions conditions are going to be the determination of your survival on any future battlefield from this time until the end of this century, easily. What does the end of this century look like militarily? I have no bloody idea. But I'm telling you, it isn't going to get better with time. Emissions conditions are the emanations that occur from human beings, from vehicles, from machines, whatever the case may be, whether it is a thermal reading of heat or a radio frequency signature of the emission itself, depending on what it is. It could be a radar, it could be a radio, it could be a transmission device, it could be a fire direction center for a TEL, an erector launcher for a missile. It could be the effectors, the sensors. It could be any number of these things are all reliant for U.S. deployment on clean 60 hertz uninterruptible power. It is the job of those who wish to defeat military organizations that happen to be their peers or happen to be so much more technologically advanced that they have to find asymmetrical advantages in defeating them. If we were to walk over to the Pacific Theater, we would discover that if the Chinese, if the U.S. happens to get into a fight in the Pacific and the Chinese make their high-value target list entirely, not bombers, not fighters, not airfields, none of that, but make it the concerted extinction event visited upon all refueling modalities in the Pacific due west of Hawaii, whether they're in the air or on the ground, and they manage to do so, whether those are going to be KC-135s or KC-46 or the short-haul refuelers that come off of U.S. aircraft carriers, if those become the number one target for all manned and unmanned aircraft and missile modalities and everything in between for the Chinese, and they manage to destroy 50% of America's refueling capability, that leaves America in a very bad place for a number of reasons, among which is lose your refueling capability, and that means that if you can't do aerial refueling, and no one does it with the amount of aircraft, I think numbering over 350 in the active inventory for the U.S., nobody on Earth comes close to having that capability. One reason for that, of course, is because the United States is a hyperpower, does have these tremendous oceans in between its foes, whether that be China or Russia, respectively, or whatever the foe of the day happens to be at the time for the Pentagon and the Oval Office. Now, the same thing applies here for generator sets. What would happen if the high-value target list for whatever peer country, by the way, Yemen's a peer country because of what they've been doing, harrying the United States Navy out of the Red Sea, and how many very expensive drones they have taken out of the air that just so happen to have title and ownership of Uncle Sam. But again, like I just alluded to in the Pacific, the high-value target strategy for the very inexpensive UAV FPV swarms is simply generator sets, not Patriots, not Patriot missiles, not fire direction centers, not radars, not any of those things, not even these massive footprints of BCT, Brigade Combat Team, Tactical Operation Centers, TOCs, the footprints thereof, or that of a division or a corps of an army. What if they developed a missile or refitted UAVs and FPVs, and it wouldn't take too much refitting to achieve this, that simply zeroed in on the peculiar and discrete characteristics of radio frequencies, signals, emanations, and noises made by all manner of gensets that NATO and the United States deploy. That every time one of those is turned on and used, it gets killed. And by the way, you can turn off a genset, but if you have a way to detect thermal signatures, it takes a good hour or two for them to cool to the ambient temperatures of the area or regions that they happen to be in, still making these generator sets eminently targetable by drones, FPVs, missiles, could be teams of infantrymen who have secreted themselves behind enemy lines into rear areas with the notion that they're not going to hit a single soldier. They're not going to take anybody out or anything out other than generator sets. What if generator sets were priority number one for an enemy and they managed to destroy more than 50, 60, 70, 80% of not only the generator sets operable in theater, but those people who maintain them? They found some way to identify them, and they became the organic part of generator set neutralization, so that every time an overworked 91 Delta was seen out there on the genset conducting maintenance, they too would find themselves in that card deck to be eliminated by the enemy in this case. What happens to America's ability to fight? Well, let me give you some examples. If you don't have generator sets, you can't have IAMD. You can't have an integrated air and missile defense system because your fire direction center consoles are black. Your erector launchers, your missiles are not cooled. They are not maintained. They are not in readiness. They can't fire. Your radars aren't turning because they're not powered. After 3 hours, when all the laptops are dead because you've run out of gen sets, and maybe even cell phones are in the hazard, except for those who happen to have a battery pack with them, where cell phones become the only means of communication because all of the laptops happen to be dead. Did I mention lights? Did I mention that gen sets power lights, which means that for half of a 24-hour day-night cycle, if this continues, how would you be able to conduct your operations on the ground in garrison, much less projecting power? What happens if gen sets, being target one and there's no gen set left alive, how does a brigade combat team or division structure or an army or a corps, depending on how extensive the damage is by eliminating gen sets wherever they are found and active near the forward line of troops? And don't kid yourselves that this wouldn't happen in the rear areas either, because the FPV and drone usage in the Ukraine has proven that not only are these ubiquitous, but defense against swarms is rather problematic. So I'm going to make a bold statement here, and that is this. America and its armed forces have become complacent when it comes to gen sets, when it comes to portable power, when it comes to the creation and maintenance of that power in an expeditionary framework, where they take it for granted that they're always going to have the power packs and the generators and the capability to create localized power with perfect and clean 60 hertz power that enables it to use all of its exquisite C4I, command, control, communications, computers, and intelligence. And that this complacency has led it to take assumptions, taking decisions even, that protection of those assets isn't important in that they are basically invulnerable. Now, I would suggest to you, of course, gen sets aren't invulnerable. I would suggest to you that what we have here is a failure of martial imagination. Because whether it's Syria, Yemen, Iran, or the big major players like Russia and China, they are not asleep at the wheel. And they are constantly making and taking evaluations on what are the soft-bellied vulnerabilities of the U.S. Armed Forces, and by extension, the NATO forces. What can be hit left of bang? What are the components that they have in the field that are a lifeblood that they're not paying attention to. What I am suggesting to the audience is that a concerted targeting of portable power generation capacity and expeditionary forces will bring them to a screeching halt in their ability to conduct current and future operations once that is done. And that no matter how many replacement generator sets one may bring forward, once the genie is out and it is seen how cost-effective it is simply to kill portable power generation modalities on the battlefield, and I suspect if this does become de rigueur for forces, that forces planet-wide will adopt this as a means to stop expeditionary players, then all bets are off on the capability to fulfill the missions that are set forth at the tactical, operational, and strategic level for expeditionary forces. Now, I offer this as a possibility, nay, a probability, of what's going to happen in future conflict in the next 25 years. I am certain there are folks brighter than myself who can think of other modalities that may be vital parts of the logistical machinations and framework for expeditionary warfare, who may be able to come up with things that are even more efficacious in bringing them down as far as their capability to conduct war. What happens if GPS is in the hazard and GPS is just zeroed out? What happens if all cellular communications mean that all of a sudden they are the number one compromising factor in warfighting to use cell phones or have cell phone networks? This, of course, includes all the communications and mesh networks that militaries currently use. Remember that I suggested this as a thought experiment where I take one apparently banal but very important element that is weaved into the fabric of the very conduct of all U.S. military and, by extension, alliance, coalition, expeditionary warfare. And we need to plan for these kind of things, because what is the fallback position if all of a sudden all power generation that is done in the field is in the hazard and is obviated or neutralized? What's the plan? How does one move forward? Oh, are you going to start the vehicles and use the vehicles systems while they were in play, whether they're batteries or whatever the case may be? I guarantee you that those FPVs and UAVs that had aligned themselves with the very peculiar emissions of the gensets have already been calibrated and manipulated in a fashion to chase down the sounds and emissions of all vehicular traffic that the U.S. military and its allies currently use. This is an extension of the revolution in military affairs that is UAVs and FPVs. And I do make the case that UAVs and FPVs will be used to take out the gensets. This doesn't mean that cheaper missile systems that are air-to-ground or ground-to-ground could not be employed to do the very same thing. The same thing could occur with guided mortar rounds or artillery rounds or whatever the case may be, where somehow a refit or modification is made so that only power generation modalities are targeted. So do this thought experiment yourself and extrapolate what the second and third order effects are of losing all of that. All of a sudden, nothing works according to the 21st century implementation of combat power, of the use of exquisite platforms, of the utility of so many things that we simply take for granted. I would suggest to everybody listening that I am making an argument here on a probability, not a possibility, And it is completely due to complacency. It is completely due to a failure of martial imagination. And if it turns out that this remains simply a thought experiment and that none of America's enemies in the future would dare to take out discreetly and targeted in a very narrow fashion all generator sets, the possibility is still there and we need to plan appropriately. So I want you to conduct these thought experiments yourself. Maybe you can think of something other than portable power generations and power generation and gen sets and things like that. What would be some of the other vulnerable elements of American expeditionary fighting that in this new era in the 21st century are going to find American forces in the fray left to bang in a fashion that they've never experienced before? So with that, I really appreciate you listening in. I'd love to hear from any former 91 Deltas or 52 Deltas, the Army MOSs for Gentex, and let me know what you think. I happen to think that I try to find how many gen sets are in the U.S. Army. Couldn't find it. As you all know, they're available as Army surplus. I have it in my hopes of purchasing one in the future and doing all the retrofits and making one of those work for me. One of my children happens to be a diesel tech. It will be a fun project for he and I. But I'd love to hear from you and let me know what you think, not only about gen sets, but what are the other apparently mundane components of American expeditionary warfare that, if targeted, would put America's operational and strategic might, much less at the tactical level, in the hazard in a very real fashion? So, thanks for listening. And you can get in touch with me at cgpodcast@pm.me. That is cgpodcast@pm.me. If this is your first time listening to War Notes, I really appreciate it. I spent the first dozen episodes in this when I inaugurated it last fall in a series called Fixing Fight Club, in which I made recommendations on how to unscrew what I see as currently this most expensive and most ineffective paper tiger in military martial history for humanity's time on Earth, which is the U.S. military. Let me know what you think if you get a chance to listen. Where if you're listening to me on your favorite podcast vendor, please be sure to leave a review. A narrative review would be much appreciated. But if you leave stars, I will be obliged. You can get in touch with me at cgpodcast@pm.me, that is cgpodcast@pm.me, or my Substack, the Chasing Ghost Substack. You will find that in the show notes. This is Bill, out.